This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today, we'll visit with the artistic director of one of the exciting choral ensembles around, one that has its roots and reasoning right from our region, Kinara Ensemble. We'll chat with J.D. Burnett. The common ground for these singers is Westminster Choir College in Princeton, and now that the ensemble is celebrating their 10th anniversary, their singers come from a wide range of locales and backgrounds, making this jet-set choral ensemble rich in talent and diverse in repertoire. My guest graduated from Westminster, then diversified his career with stints directing the Dallas Symphony Chorus, Masterworks Chorus of New Jersey, and the New Jersey Youth Chorus Young Men's Ensemble. Kinara Ensemble have just released their debut CD on the Effetto label called Provenance. This is the label founded and run by our good friend, recording engineer John Baker. Except for one selection, we'll be listening to tracks from that disc throughout the program, such as now, as you're hearing Kinara Ensemble perform music of American composer Morten Lauridsen, his Soneto de la Noche from Nocturnes, setting texts of the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda. You'll get to hear more of Kinara Ensemble next Tuesday in our noontime concert, a concert they presented celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. I spoke with my guest from Georgia, as he is assistant professor and associate director of choral activities at the University of Georgia, Hugh Hodgson School of Music. Very happy today to be talking with conductor, singer, teacher, J.D. Burnett. Congratulations on the new CD, Provenance, out on the Effetto label. This is Kanar Ensemble's debut recording, and the ensemble's 10 years now, right? That's what you're celebrating?
That's right. It's our 10th anniversary season. We got started in the fall of 2008, and so we're excited to be offering a 10-year anniversary season, and that included the release of the CD Provenance.
So if you go back to that time, the start of the group, was the common ground Westminster Choir College, and how and why form this group back then? What was the impetus for getting together and making another choir, another ensemble?
Yeah, indeed it was alumni of Westminster Choir College who had recently graduated and were in that kind of liminal space between education and regular employment and looking for an opportunity to continue to make music at the level that they were accustomed as students there. And it was a small group of about 8 or 9. I was actually not involved in that first concert that they did and came in January of 2009. And the stories that I've been told is really that they just wanted to continue singing. They fashioned a holiday program and offered that in December and rehearsed and recorded a version of that, and off they went.
So as the mindset saying, okay, we're going to hang together here, like you say, you're in that kind of no man's land, graduation has happened, oh boy, now we're in the real world type of thing, and we're going to stay together as a choir. So now you've got decisions. Now you come into the mix as director. So you're going to present concerts where, how, the programming, the repertoire, what will the choir focus on? Are there going to be concentrations? Things like this. I mean, how were decisions like that sort of handled when this group got off the ground?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because when groups like ours are formed, there are a number of ways that people set that up. Some people wait to actually perform until they have tons of backing and financial things in place and an administrative team, and they never sing a note for a couple of years in the planning process. Ours was very much the opposite. Everybody just wanted to sing. And so my first interest was, since this was going to be a conducted ensemble, I wanted to make it slightly bigger than what they had been. I wanted to add some singers. And so we did. And the first concert that I gave was about 16 or 18 singers. And I think that we were looking for a place to sing. And so we just contacted people we knew and said, hey, can we sing a concert at your church? And then we, you know, reached out to our friends, said, come listen to us sing. And that's the way it went for quite a while, I will say. And only in the last 5-6 years have we gotten to a place where we're more organized and that sort of thing. We put a board into place and got incorporated and did all the things that nonprofits do to sustain themselves. And then we found ourselves able to look down the road longer than about, you know, 10 weeks, and we made whole season plans, and now we're, you know, we plan several years out. And so it's been a full journey. We limped along for a while, but now it really feels like we've seen the whole journey and we can appreciate it in a way that I'm not sure, you know, every organization like us can.
Yeah, if it was like 20, 30 years ago, it would have been everybody bringing their Rolodexes. But for you guys, 10 years ago, it was you know, everybody hit their contact lists, right?
That's right. And thank goodness for social media in that way. Yeah. So email and Facebook and that sort of thing was our friend as we try to recruit listeners and venues.
Just that one part of the question, I mean, as far as repertoire, you've got all these people coming in. They all have different interests in what they would like to sing in the choir. You're put in the position of director. Were you trying to bring some focus as to what the choir would be, what would be the DNA of this choir as far as repertoire?
Yeah, I sort of saw that as the quickest path forward was to have a rather clear vision for what the ensemble would be in terms of who the singers were and what the repertoire would be. And so that has been, ever since I stepped on board, my responsibility. And, you know, it works differently. There are groups out there who share responsibility for the artistic shaping of the process. But I think that one of the reasons that I was invited to join the effort was because they felt the need, I think, for a clearer point of view artistically and someone to stand and listen and reflect. And I was happy to do that.
In 2008, things were already not quite as they were. So along this trajectory of years with Kanara, what was the first time, hey, let's make a recording sort of came up in discussions or in the planning, or where does that fit in? Because it's now been released, but how long has this been dreamed of and planned for?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we live in a world of recorded sound, and so that's been on the radar all along. Well, I think I mentioned a minute ago, one of the first things they did, this was before I came on board, was that they made just a basic recording, a sort of live recording of the concert they were about to do, and then they sold it at the concert. So it was obviously on the radar from square one. But when I came on board, I was a little more patient, I think, with that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to wait until I felt we had a really established identity as both a musical voice and a community of people. And I wanted to make sure that there was a repertoire that we felt like we were really living in the middle of and wanted to offer on a more public level. And so while there were many requests along the way over the last decade, when are you going to make a CD? We want a CD. It was probably on me a little bit to try to hang back a little bit and wait for the right moment. And I felt like in the last couple of years, we could have done it in any of the last 2 or 3 years, but this was the right timing to mark our 10th anniversary. And I felt like we had a program that I wanted to send out into the world, as it were.
From their debut CD Provenance on the Effetto label, here is Canara Ensemble singing Philip Wilby's arrangement of the tune Marianne. Canara is led by their artistic director and my guest today, J.D. Burnett. This choir, like you said, the common ground were these Westminster Choir College graduates wanted to keep singing. But this choir now, as your ranks have grown, the singers, correct me if I'm wrong on this, come from all over the place, drawing kind of on your experience with Santa Fe Desert Chorale and Conspirari and things. So this is one of these kind of newish phenomena of these jet set chorales, right? Where people sort of come in and prepare the concert and do the concert and then it's kind of sort of scatter. I mean, I'm talking to you and we'll get to it from Georgia. So it seems to be successful. There are groups, ones I just mentioned, but I'm thinking of also Seraphic Fire down in Florida, things like that. How the heck does this work logistically? How do you overcome what might seem like nightmare problems of everybody coming in intensely rehearsing, presenting a concert? I mean, talk about how this thing works.
Yeah, you've nailed it. I mean, while it provides us beautiful and nimble ability to assemble like a large number of very talented singers from all over, there are liabilities to it too. There's something that's really special about a choir that sings and breathes and rehearses together on a weekly basis, whereas we are only together 4 or 5 times a year. But the phenomenon that has just cropped up over the last 20 years, I'd say, is one that singers who would love to have made their livings doing choral work 2 decades ago would have only dreamed of. And now we have a whole environment, a whole landscape of professional choirs around the country where singers can, if they like, they can make their living as a choral singer, traveling from city to city and engagement to engagement. Our roster, while it did begin, as you described, with a small group of young alumni from Westminster, probably still informed in some way and forever stamped with that Westminster spirit.
Right.
I think it now reflects a wide variety of training and experience in our roster. They really do come from all over the place. I could probably easily named 25 states that our singers come from. We probably have a roster of over 100 singers and staff each cycle as we feel is appropriate for whatever the given repertoire is. And it's an exciting time to be a professional choral musician because this was not true. I mean, if you wanted to make your living singing in a choir 25 years ago, your options were really the military choruses or Chanticleer or the Metropolitan Opera Chorus.
Yeah.
And now you can make a living as a professional choral singer by appearing with many different ensembles.
You don't even have to do it in your hometown. You can jet somewhere and sing in a professional choir and have a great experience doing it.
Many of my colleagues are with us for a week in Princeton, and then they're off to Boston or Tucson or Kansas City or California. You know, it's hard work. It sounds kind of glamorous, but it's a hard work. And
yeah,
there are a couple singers out there right now who really claim no home base because they're on the road most of the time. So while it, like I said, while it's a really neat thing that's going on right now, it'll be interesting to watch how singers manage that lifestyle over the course of a larger number of years.
How do you then, as director, I mean, you want to keep the same personnel, especially if everything's clicking and working, but you'll have changes and you've got these people who do have lives in other areas. So it's not like you see them every week and know that they're starting a family, having a baby, something's happening here, something's happening in their life. I mean, how do you keep a sound that you want? Not that, you know, Kanara has a specific sound, but I mean, you're striving for that. How do you keep that with this kind of setup and the change that might happen in your group?
Yeah, this is one of the things I find most fascinating about the effect of the choral scene that we've been talking about is that while many of these singers appear with all these different organizations, they're often together. So a lot of these singers are singing together all the time. So in one way, that's a way to maintain a connection between people and shared aesthetic. But what has proven itself to me in my experience conducting and also in singing in some of these choirs, because I've done a fair amount of that myself, and then also listening to other choirs, is it's renewed my belief that the conductor is actually important. And that even though these are a group of singers that sing a lot in different places, boy, they sound different depending on where they are and who's in front of them. And I think that's beautiful. I think it adds an amazing texture to the output of choral music in our country, and it makes it all the more exciting and challenging and unique and invigorating to me as a conductor.
I want to get to the CD, but before we do, just a little bit about you. So you graduate Westminster and you go out. Now, you've taught, I just said I'm talking to you from Georgia because you're the assistant professor of music and associate director of choral activities at the University of Georgia, the U. Hodgins School of Music. You've worked with professional choirs, Dallas Symphony Orchestra Chorus, choral organizations such as Masterworks Chorus in New Jersey, youth groups, New Jersey Youth Chorus Young Men's Ensemble. But when you got the diploma at Westminster, now you go out, especially as a conductor, as a singer, you said it's a pretty cool time to be, you know, a choral singer. But what avenues upon graduation were there? Were all those avenues there? Did you have to seek them out? Was it pick and choose? And maybe advice to somebody graduating now as a choral conductor. What was there in front of you that you could grab upon graduation?
Yeah, I talk to students about this on a regular basis, like what is the career path? What's
correct,
the
yeah.
trajectory? And there is a common wisdom about this and some guidance that we offer students kind of categorically that I'll get to in a second. But the thing that I have come to believe both through my own experience, which I have felt is not quite as beeline as some of my colleagues, and through observing the careers of other conductors, is that we arrive at the places that we arrive through many, many different paths. And as much as we try to set ourselves up for a certain success in one way or another, or a certain career path, it rarely goes exactly like you think. I assume this is true in all careers, but mm-hmm. we might guide people to say, okay, if your goal is to be a university professor in choral music, you're going to need a master's and a doctorate. You're going to need teaching experience in as many different environments as you can. And it needs to go in this order or this order. And so that's the sort of pat guidance that we offer students. But it doesn't always go that way. Like, for instance, for me, I graduated from my undergrad and went and taught high school for 5 years in suburban Houston, an experience that I treasured and on many days look back on fondly. And then I went and did a master's degree at Westminster. And so then having taught, the next logical kind of by the book step would have been to go straight into a doctoral program, but I didn't feel ready at that moment to pull the trigger on further study. I wasn't sure where I would be best suited. And so I ended up teaching for 4 years on a couple of different music faculties in situations that I was either replacing someone or filling in for a year or teaching adjunct or whatever it might have been. But what that helped me to discover was, yes, indeed, like I feel like I love this. I feel like I have something to offer and something to say here. And so then it is worth it to me to commit to this doctoral study and go back and do it so that I can set myself up for a tenurable university track somewhere. So in guiding young conductors, I offer the same advice that I think most do and the one I already articulated, but I also try to qualify that to say people do it all kinds of ways. And sometimes you can, if you're one of those kind of doers who lines up and tries to get everything ready and so your sort of success is guaranteed, yeah. Sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes if you're a wanderer and you don't really kind of know exactly where you're going to fit in, success finds you. And by success, I mean happiness, really. The latter is a little bit more like what I feel like I've experienced. And between the responsibilities I have here at the University of Georgia, a great school of music with wonderful students, and the work I do with Kanara Ensemble, you know, that happiness has found me in many ways.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. And then the word you sort of kept coming back to sort of in that round of theme is patience. Just, you know, wait to see what happens and then use that experience. That's great.
Yeah. To be open to possibilities.
Yeah. To be open.
Just kind of know when to jump.
Music of Argentinian composer Alberto Ginastera, as performed by my guest J.D. Burnett and his Kanara Ensemble. This, the O Vos Omnis movement from Ginastera's Lamentations of Jeremiah.
Thank you.
the new recording on a federal label, the Provenance. This one-word title is not uncommon to Kinnar. If you look ahead to your season, you've got a concert in January called Solace. Meditation comes in March, Americana in June. Does the one-word title, is it just the idea of something broad where a lot can fit under the umbrella? Is that the idea of just being able to give a direction to the concert or the recording in this case, and then being able to be very creative in the programming?
Yeah, we have favored one-word titles for a few years now. I feel like it's something that serves us well and gives an impulse of an idea, a thread through a concert of repertoire. It also allows me a fair amount of flexibility in how I program. And we certainly titled the CD Provenance because it reflects our roots, where we've come from.
Right.
You know, and in that vein, we have performed music for the recording that has been on programs previously at some point over the course of the development of Kinnara. And so we're going to stick with those single word titles, I think, for a while until it feels right to change it. But, you know, it just feels consistent with our gestalt, or, you know, what's unique to us. And I've liked it so far.
Do you find the overabundance problem on that side, where so many pieces would work on a concert, whatever the title is of the concert? Then you've got to start making some hard decisions, right, about programming. Or does the choir lead you in that way? I mean, how do you toss out things and bring them in and range the repertoire in each?
Yeah, the choir informs the repertoire in a sort of indirect way. I feel like because I want to perform music that I know will suit them beautifully. I know them. I know who they are. I know how they sound. I know what they love. You know, certainly those people and the aggregate group really does inform rep. But usually there's a ton of choral music rep,
sure,
out there. And so we can't do it all, but usually these programs take shape around one or two pieces of music that I really want to perform. And I ruminate on those things and what I think would fit nicely and balance the program. And then somewhere along the line there emerges a theme that we try to encapsulate with a title. But certainly there's tons of music that doesn't make it onto every program that begins in the stack of possibilities.
So for this CD, just looking at the pieces on here, you already mentioned these are things that sort of can trace the origins, the source over the years of Kinnara that you've done, that have had a special place with the chorus. It's a wide range. I mean, I was kind of struck, to be honest with you, for something like the Ginastera, things like that, and I'm glad to see the Paulus pieces. Maybe just go over, not every piece, but just in general mentioning some of these pieces and how and why they fit onto this particular CD.
It is a varied body of repertoire, for sure. Just as they come to my head, I think about the Brahms double choir motets. I always sort of say these might be my favorite pieces of choral music. They speak to me, and I just love them dearly. I feel like they're maybe a little bit less known than some of the other a cappella music by Brahms, and so I wanted an opportunity to sing those and record those. The Ginastera were pieces that I fell in love with that I feel like are known by the knowers in the choral business, but maybe a little bit less familiar to more casual audiences. But pieces by a really young composer that are challenging, and there aren't a lot of recordings of them. And so I thought that was a good one. Poulenc is a voice that's unmistakable, and I feel like the choir sings that stuff really well and sort of settles with us really quickly. And then I wanted to begin and end with things that I found rather special, you know, and it so happened that things presented themselves right around the key center of E. So we have the opening chant that begins and ends in E that goes straight into the first pitch of a mostly A major-ish beginning of the Lassus motet.
Right.
And then at the end, we've got two folk songs, the Marianne and Shenandoah, both in the key of E major. And then without boring everybody with the specificity, these are all pieces too, and I haven't talked a lot about this to the choir, really anybody, but these are all pieces that are meaningful to me because I associate each of them with an important mentor of mine.
Okay.
And I've had many. I've been really fortunate as a singer and student to sing for some really great and learn from some really great conductors. And so it has an added layer of meaning to me based on that.
That's a nice underlayer to the programming on the CD. Beloved by my guest, Artistic Director of Kinnara Ensemble, J.D. Burnett. Here he is, leading Kinnara from their debut CD Provenance on the Effetto label, performing Brahms's motet Wo ist ein so herrlich Volk? Where is there so holy a people?
Thank you.
Speaking of programming and one-word titles, next Tuesday, we're going to broadcast a concert you gave in Princeton a few weeks back. And I feel, especially for choral ensembles and choirs, but maybe even for organists, things like that, history has handed you a themed concert this year because October 31st is the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation and Martin Luther and such. So when you don't have to think of a word that ties in all the pieces, but it's actually put right in your lap. But you also know that hundreds, if not thousands, of other ensembles and especially choirs are also looking at this as a chance to present a concert around this theme. So how did you approach this concert about music of the Reformation?
You're right. It sort of did fall in our lap. It seemed like a no-brainer.
It's a no-brainer,
Yeah, I think a lot of people are biting on that bait too. I mean, this is great music. And I think that the way I tried to pick it was that I knew that I was looking for a concert cycle around a small number of singers. Typically, we perform somewhere between 24 and 32 singers. We've done as small as 16, but I wanted to do something that was much more intimate and knew that I was looking for something to do for 8 singers at some point, and this seemed to be really, really obvious. And so in deciding, okay, we're going to do a Reformation concert with 8 singers, then that limits us some ways in that we wanted it to be an a cappella concert. I wanted to be consistent with who we have been, although we're not constrained by that, and at some point, you know, there'll be lots of instruments in front of us when we feel the time's right. But that narrowed the field a little bit. And I wanted it to be, I feel like the word survey is a little bit of a cheap one, but a sense of the diaspora of this movement, you know, from area to area. It's not hard to find a lot of really hearty, sturdy Lutheran music from Germany. But we wanted to include some, too, that was from France and England. And so we did, and wanted it to be a balanced program, too, with some favorites that a lot of people would recognize, because they'll come to a concert of Reformation music kind of expecting to hear certain things. So they probably expect to hear Bach. Mm-hmm. So we did a Bach motet. They might expect to hear Schütz, and so there's Schütz on the concert. But surprising them, too, with some of their favorites from the Anglican tradition, you know, a couple of Talus motets and that sort of thing. And then maybe even educating a little bit and trying to add texture to the program with a couple of French pieces that in many ways are unmistakably French in that they are chanson in sacred garb. These sort of secular forms that people slapped sacred texts on and called it sacred music. And, you know, that was the case with the inception of the Reformation even. I mean, Martin Luther did the very same thing. He took popular tunes and put sacred words to them. And so that was how that took shape and how we sort of fashioned our program.
We will feature Canara Ensemble, led by their artistic director and my guest today, J.D. Burnett, next Tuesday as our noontime concert, performances taken from their series of concerts they gave last month commemorating the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Here's a sneak preview, as we'll hear Canara Ensemble perform Heinrich Schütz's setting of Psalm 98, Singet dem Herrn ein neues Lied, Sing to the Lord a new song.
Thank you.
So, first recording out, you're crossing the 10-year mark, things to check off. What's ahead for Canara? What are the plans in the coming years?
Right. We're in the business of strategizing over the course of 5 and 10 years right now, and we're thinking about what do we want to be in over the course of those times. You know, I don't think that there's anything that's going to fundamentally change about who we are. I mean, we are steeped in the a cappella choral tradition. But as I, you know, mentioned a minute ago, we'd like to do late Baroque works with, you know, continuo groups and strings and winds and that sort of thing. And I think that's probably not too far in the offing because that's music that I love and that singers love to sing. I think we'd like to develop a sturdier audience base in Princeton and New Jersey in general. I think in some ways we are such a saturated area in New Jersey with exquisite music and especially choral music. There's a corridor there between Boston, New York, and Philadelphia and on down to DC that's just really rich in choral music. And so we need to distinguish ourselves some way and get the word out that we're here and doing what we're doing. But we'd also like to develop presence outside of the area. We're going to offer our first concert cycle in Atlanta in January. And looking forward to that opportunity to sing for new audiences and new metropolitan areas. And certainly, I think we feel happy with the recording and look forward to doing more of that. So, I mean, in a nutshell, I think those are the things.
What about new pieces, about, you know, being the first choir to present something new?
We'd love to do that. And that's been a part that's been absent from our story so far. But I do think that this is a choir that would sing new music and commissions, real fresh stuff, very beautifully. And I would love that. Some of that, I mean, it's no secret that some of that, there's a financial consideration
sure,
to that.
Yeah.
And so as we grow as an organization, maybe that'll become a little bit more a possibility for us. But certainly, yeah, we'd love to do that.
Well, and you know, the trend right now for new music are these consortium commissions, where maybe you can get some of those choral ensembles that are like Canara, you know, and band together and commission a composer. And then, you know, the composer gets 4 or 5 performances out of it, and all of you get a new piece to sing. It works in other areas, you know?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think that'd be a great thing for us to try.
Well, we wish you a great another decade ahead of Canara. And of course, when you come to Princeton, anybody listening here in the Princeton area, go out to hear them. Their roots are here. We'll put it that way. The roots are here. I close on my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. And the first is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat like we've been doing with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to talk with. When I asked that, what was the first name that came to your head? Someone you'd love to pick their brain.
Today, the first one was Bach.
It was Bach. I don't
know. Yeah, maybe he's just kind of on my mind right now. But boy, I mean, I don't know. We've been talking for the better part of an hour here or whatever, and I think I could fill a day or two with Bach.
Yeah, well, you may get pressed into service, you understand?
Yeah,
You might be singing, you know, here's the tenor bass part on these cantatas. Just do what you can.
Yeah, you might hand me a violin too, and I'd panic.
The final question's a non-musical question, meaning everybody I interview on Cadenza is extremely busy with music in their life. You're teaching and conducting all the rest of this. When you have to get away from music, a little respite, relaxation, pleasure, enjoyment, but I have to pull away for a second, what do you do?
Well, you're right. Those little moments are hard to find and sometimes hard to plan for. And so for me, they come at surprising times. So sometimes I catch up on TV. I love Netflix and Hulu as much as the next guy. And so there are shows that go, you know, for a long time that I don't get to catch up on. In the right times of year, I really like working outside in my yard.
Okay.
And so those are a couple things that come to mind on this Wednesday of my life.
You're a binger, huh? When you need to be.
It's true. It's true.
J.D. Burnett, thanks for taking some time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, David.
J.D. Burnett, Artistic Director of Kinara Ensemble. You can find out more about them at their website, Kinara, K-I-N-N-A-R-A, ensemble.org. Their debut CD, Provenance, from which we've been sampling throughout this program, has been released on our good friend, recording engineer John Baker's label, Effetto. The label is distributed by Naxos, so you can check it out at naxos.com. Or check out other titles on John's label at Effetto, A-F-F-E-T-T-O, records.com. As I have mentioned, you can hear more of Kinara Ensemble next Tuesday at noon, as we'll present as our noontime concert their Reformation concerts given last month to commemorate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. In addition to music by Luther, Schütz, Bach, they'll also perform music by Josquin, Talis, Brahms, and Hugo Distler. That's next Tuesday at noon. I'll leave you with yet another track from their debut CD, Provenance, on the Effetto label. This from the late American composer Stephen Paulus. His The Day Is Done, performed by Kinara Ensemble, led by their artistic director and my guest today, J.D. Burnett. As always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.